You are listening to Single Service. My name is Arno Martire, and I am your host. Single Service is a podcast dealing with design, architecture, business, and city building, in which I interview an expert on a specific subject matter. Together, we dive into that topic and challenge conventional thinking in a thought-provoking conversation. I sincerely hope that you will find these conversations as engaging as I did and learn a thing or two in the process. Don't forget to send us your comments, criticism, and praise. To do so, you can email us at hello@rvltr.studio or leave a comment online. You can also subscribe to the podcast on our website at rvltr.studio. Rachel Cohen-Murison is a designer and entrepreneur based out of Toronto. She runs Density, an online planning tool that helps Canadian homeowners understand their property's eligibility to build a backyard home. She's interested in applying data at a granular level to help policymakers and builders make better housing decisions. Check it out at www.density.build, and Density is D-E-N-C-I-T-Y, which is a nice pun, if I may. So thank you very much, Rachel, for joining us on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Arno.
So we're going to start with a really hard question. Obviously, that's a joke, but can you tell us who you are and what you do in your own words in three sentences or less? And I'm not going to count the sentences, so it's just a guide.
Okay, tricky, yeah. I'll try to keep it succinct, but basically I'm a Toronto-based designer with an architecture background, currently involved in the accessory dwelling unit sphere. So that means everything backyard home. I have developed a software, as you said, to allow homeowners to understand their eligibility to build a backyard home. I'm a consultant with a marketplace for backyard homes in Canada, as well as working alongside with a builder, West Coast builder of modular housing. So yeah, everything to do with backyard housing.
That's great. And I'll be sure to link all those relevant websites in the show description.
Perfect.
So let's start with the genesis of Density. How did the idea of this business come about?
Yeah, so it was really during the pandemic. My partner and I had some extra time on our hands, as some people did. And, you know, we saw what was happening with the laneway suite policies in the city. More and more homeowners, specifically in Toronto, were interested in understanding their eligibility to build backyard homes, but they really had very few resources, you know, maybe a Facebook group to kind of ask other homeowners how to build. They didn't understand the bylaws. You know, I was getting questions even from other clients through work about ADUs, backyard housing, laneway suites in different cities. So yeah, we thought, why not take my architecture background and knowledge, being able to decipher bylaws, and put that to code with a 2D, 3D interface. And that was my partner's strong suit, coming from computer science. So yeah, that's kind of how it started.
That makes a lot of sense. So was there a specific problem that you might want to expand on a little bit that you were trying to solve with this platform?
Yeah, I think so. At first, it just started off as, you know, a homeowner-centric tool to better convey to homeowners like exactly their property's eligibility. But then it turned into much more of a global mapping tool for us to better understand the city and see how many properties are eligible for a one-story or two-story unit. What is the true impact in terms of a missing middle solution that laneway suites or garden suites can have in a city like Toronto? And it turns out, you know, there are thousands and thousands of properties that could be densified at with a very low bar of entry for homeowners to invest in or companies, what have you. Yeah. And so it turned into a much bigger thing where I also kind of pivoted from capital A architecture more into kind of understanding bylaws and zoning at a much larger level. Yeah.
So would it be a fair assessment to say that without a tool like yours, homeowners would have to hire some kind of expert to analyze their property and tell them what they could do?
Yes, definitely. I would also say, though, that this is like a stepping stone. I would say density is a stepping stone for homeowners to get into it. There's also a costing calculator that's part of it. But, you know, they should still consult a professional to kind of get into the weeds with an on-site check, you know, site measure, getting into a full design, signing on a design professional or a builder.
Of course. That makes sense. And so that's been going on for a couple of years now. What has been the evolution of the tool, and who has it served mostly, or what kind of use cases did you see come out of your initial idea?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, at first it was mainly homeowners coming to me wanting to pursue further site eligibility studies in person. So like they use the tool, but they still have questions. Mm-hmm. Funny enough, even those who I would deem have like a pretty good understanding of the bylaw, they still found the tool super useful to clarify their thoughts. And then they still might have a few questions, so they would still come to me. And yeah, we'd do an on-site study, or I'd, you know, send them off to another consultant.
And so the Laneway suites have been legal for a few years now. So aside from your tool specifically, what has the uptake been until now? And is it what the city hoped it would be?
Right, with Laneway suites, you know, I have to say yes, like there are more permits being processed in terms of Laneway suites, but the true barrier is financing. Like if people can't finance, they can't build. So regardless of the Laneway suite bylaws having been slightly approved upon recently in a city like Toronto, garden suites being made legal as of last autumn, I believe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even other cities like Hamilton improving, West Coast is improving their bylaws. Again, if there's not enough financing, then homeowners can't build. So
what is the barrier in terms of financing that homeowners are facing? Because does it require a new form of financing? Is it hard to borrow for this kind of project? What are the kind of parameters that people have to deal with?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. Basically, the banks here are not used to seeing products or creating products for backyard homes, right? They're used to seeing a primary dwelling and offering a second mortgage or home equity line of credit on this. But, you know, I believe it takes about, 30 Laneway suites, let's say in Toronto, to convince a bank. This is a mortgage broker of mine who told me this, to then create a product for Laneway suites, let alone garden suites, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. You know, you're seeing home equity line of credit being offered more in a city like Toronto, but we're going to have to wait to see the same product being offered for garden suites. Yeah. And that's just one prong. There might be government help at one point. There might be smaller banks or credit unions offering products in the very near future. So let's see.
So are you saying that to this day, there's still no specific financial product for Laneway suites?
I know. I believe that like TD might offer something, a home equity line of credit, taking into consideration, again, with these 30 data points to offer a financial product, but nothing specific at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. And I see it. I have a neighbor who just got a garden suite approved. So he was probably one of the first ones. And he's going to build it himself because he just doesn't have a lot of financing or cash to do it. So it's interesting to see that the financing alone can make or break a project. So beyond the financing, let's talk a little bit more about the housing shortage. What would you say are the main causes of the situation we're in right now, in your opinion?
Yeah, another, very good question. I would say, we've gone through this huge surge in housing costs. Obviously, a part of the solution is supply, but it is definitely not all of it. There should likely be government intervention at a certain point, renter protection, different, hybrid models of like rent geared to income, profit sharing, reducing barriers to permitting is very significant, reducing red tape, removing exclusionary zoning. all of these are really good mechanisms that I hope will be implemented in the near future. And I do see them starting to be implemented throughout Ontario and throughout BC. I think in the next few months, by the end of the year, we should be hearing from the BC Premier about doing away with single family zoning across the whole province and allowing for up to fourplex, so multiplexes on every property, as well as an ADU.
Oh, that would be great. And I'm glad you mentioned the regulatory issue, because I've talked to a lot of people about this problem. And my conclusion is that a large part of the responsibility in where we are today is regulatory in nature. It's the length of permitting, the cost of permitting, the ability of that neighbors have to throw a monkey wrench into works with the Committee of Adjustment, the Committee of Adjustment itself, the fact that for even minor variances, you have to go through this incredibly onerous and complicated process. And I think if politician, and it's relevant right now because we're about to elect a new mayor in Toronto, which will happen before this podcast is released, but it's very topical, because I think if we could elect someone who realizes that they just need to get out of the way and simplify everything. Taxation is also a major issue in the problem, both with sales tax and development charges, which are insane.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all issues that need to be addressed. And in my opinion, the regulatory environment is not immensely simplified, no matter what other solutions we come up with, increased density as of right, laneway suite, garden suites, whatever else, it's not going to solve those problems, and it's still going to be just as complicated to build anything. The problem is that I don't want to get political, but it seems like the front runners in the mayoral race are not really particularly good on the issue.
Yeah.
So if we don't elect someone who's going to solve that problem in Toronto, I'm not talking about elsewhere. I don't know what it isn't like in other cities, but I have a hunch that it's a similar problem. Are there any other options for people to just, or for us as a culture or society to make it happen? Because if we can't rely on politicians, maybe we have to take the matter in our own hands, right?
Yeah, I know. It's incredibly frustrating. And I agree with you in terms of like the political stakeholders, like they definitely are a significant piece of the pie. They are the ones who will have control over taxation, changing the way things are with the development charges, property tax, everything. In terms of, you know, I don't want to say mechanisms to, like, there is a potential for private industry to try to come in and suggest things to the government. I'm also involved with a group called ADU Search. They were funded by the CMHC in round one of the Housing Supply Challenge. I'm involved as a consultant with them to try to help them develop a marketplace for ADUs across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And for sure, like, you know, they're talking to government entities. We're all trying to push for the same thing, but even in terms of one little piece of the pie that they can take off as a marketplace, it's enough to at least try to show the government for now, like, this is a viable market, homeowners are interested. Now you need to try to push things on your end to reduce permitting times, defer development costs for affordable housing or for low-level development, right? Push taxation in a different way, perhaps.
Yeah. And so, I always like to think in terms of solving problems by looking at the incentives of that all parties involved are dealing with. Is there a way to incentivize politicians, maybe it's with an increased tax base or whatever the case may be, to convince them that it's also in their interest to do it, and that facing the wrath of NIMBYs might be worth the trouble?
Yeah, I mean, look, you could provide the government with an opportunity cost, right? Of like how many workers and what percentage of your tax basis will you lose if you don't develop the housing for mm-hmm. your key skilled, you know, skilled and unskilled workers in the near future? You'll lose hospital workers. You'll lose everyone from every industry if you don't provide them housing.
Mm-hmm.
So someone needs to do this study.
Yeah, that would be very interesting to see. Because you often hear that the, you know, most Canadians' retirement money is tied in housing, and the idea is that you buy something, it increases in value over the course of your lifetime, and then you sell it when you retire to downsize, and you use the proceeds to fund your retirement. Do you think there's any danger, if that's truly the case, and it seems to be, for a large portion of the population, that if you increased supply, their nest egg might suffer? Or is there such a shortage that no matter how much we build, prices won't come down for a long, long while? And how would you address that issue? Because I think that's one of the reasons, primary reasons, even though they don't necessarily openly speak about it, why NIMBYs oppose new developments, is that they're afraid that their property values are going to go down. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So you're wondering if, you know, we put in changes, or if the property values come down, that they will lose their nest egg to pay for their retirement. I would counter that by saying, well, what will you get again once all your skilled workers leave, in terms of those providing you with healthcare, with, you know, working at the grocery store, everyone around you in the community that you need to interact and survive with? And also, why not give others a chance? I'm not even saying the next generation need to be property owners. They could equally be renters, but allow them to have an opportunity to thrive in the same country that you've, you know, thrived in as well.
Mm-hmm.
There are alternate models to get to a, you know, a sustainable retirement than taking it through your house. Even as a renter, again, you could do renter-focused or rent-geared-to-income profit-sharing models, the likes of which I've seen work relatively well in Europe. Again, we don't need to even crash like everyone's house value to bring in some sort of step for, you know, first-time home buyers or renters to achieve mm-hmm. some sort of stability in their lives in Canada, but something needs to change.
Yeah. And I was just being the devil's advocate. Obviously, I don't believe that there's any danger of those values going down because you would increase the supply. If anything, mm-hmm. they might go down because if the interest rates keep going up, the mortgage terms get redefined and people get upside down on their mortgage and default. And that's what could, if the prices keep going up, basically, and as well as the interest rates, that's what could crash the market. You could have a similar crisis as what you had in the States in 2008. And there's also, apparently, from what I understand, a lot of evidence that if you increase the housing supply, that generally increases the value of the properties around it. Because if you have more valuable properties, say, because you can put fourplexes by as of right,
mm-hmm.
the houses in the neighborhood will benefit from it as well. Like more people doesn't mean devalued property, quite the opposite. And there's a lot of denser cities in the world, Paris, New York, London, where property values are insane, and they have a lot more people than we do. Anyway, that's a bit of a digression, but I think it's going to be a battle of not just logic, because logic doesn't work in those instances. It's really about showing people that it's in their best interests to let others build and incentivizing them in some sense, politicians or NIMBYs or other stakeholders in the process, by showing that they will benefit from it as well. Because I think that the problem we're seeing right now is there's a bit of a battle of wills between people who don't want to increase density because there are the incumbents with the property values that have gone through the roof and have benefited from it. And the people like me and perhaps you as well, who haven't been lucky enough to enter the market at the right time mm-hmm. and are now finding ourselves in a more precarious situation than even 5 or 10 years ago.
Sure.
And instead of pitting one against each other, I think it's really about showing each side that they can all benefit from increased density and more vibrant culture and society, especially in a big city like Toronto that keeps on growing and never seems to stop.
That's it. And we all want to be part of this city. So,
yeah, so far. I mean, it was sure. I just want to leave, but that's a different story. So let's talk a little bit about your tool more. What's the role of data in urban planning, policymaking, and design?
Yeah, so I'd say, you know, it's kind of multifaceted, but in terms of what we do with density, you know, there's a front end, so a homeowner facing app. But as I mentioned, there's also the back end. We're able to apply a data science approach to analyze all this data and see, you know, what the ideal footprint is for a laneway suite or a garden suite. You know, also kind of envisioning something in a 3D tool is pretty useful for a city like Toronto or Vancouver, mm-hmm. Where there are all these like angular plane requirements. And from a homeowner's perspective, yeah, they wouldn't
That's
understand
another regulatory
that.
Regulatory hurdle we need to do away with.
Sure, exactly. Yeah, maybe a carryover from more NIMBY policies of the past, but especially in Vancouver. But yeah, that's kind of something to help people at a very like vernacular level understand bylaws as applied to space. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and we've kind of extended this into Seashelt as well. You'll notice on our website, it's not just Toronto. We also offer Seashelt BC on the Sunshine Coast, kind of small city north of Vancouver. So you can kind of play around with putting one of the row homes on a property there.
Mm-hmm. And so the data you work with, you said part of it is collecting from the people who use your tool, but the existing data that allows you to perform those analyses, is that data that's freely available? Like how did you get access to it?
Yeah, so the data you can actually find on Toronto's open data portal. Anyone can go in and download. They have, you know, different iterations every few months, updates to the data, and it's all kind of GIS-based, so mm-hmm. geospatial.
And so that data is basically open source, and you're building a tool on top of that to do those analyses of people's properties, right?
That's it, yeah. And I inject the bylaw kind of info on top of the geospatial through code, and that's what you get at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. So let's broaden the conversation even a little more. And because you're kind of at the forefront, I think, of developing tech-based tools to simplify the process and maximize people's property values. What do you think the future is looking like when we're talking about applying tech to architecture planning or construction?
Yeah, so I would also just go back there, a little note about maximizing property values. Although that is obviously like a concern that homeowners want to preserve their property value, not have it go down. It's not always the impetus behind building. A lot of homeowners from the survey I did with Density a few months ago, mm-hmm. their primary motive was actually to house family. And then second was rental income. Third was age in place. And there were a few other.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what my neighbor is doing. He's selling the garden suite to house his kids because they can't afford to live in the city. When he gets to retirement age, his kids can take over the main house and he can move into the garden suite as his retirement home. Basically, that's the whole idea. So I could totally see that playing out literally in my backyard.
Yeah, exactly. But in terms of, I guess you asked about the future of, you know, tech as applied to architecture, planning, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the way I see it, you know, there are a few kind of companies in the picture right now that are doing something similar to Density in terms of providing a digital planning tool, whether it be ADU Search, Ratio City in Toronto, Symbium out of California. They have a very interesting model called Comp Law. I believe they've kind of submitted their own, they've created their own word there, computational law. But basically, all of us kind of operate in this realm of applying geospatial data in a kind of an online software to allow homeowners, policymakers, planning and permitting offices to speed up processes, right? So the way I see it, there will be more and more city-based permitting softwares. That's what Symbium's doing with their Build product in, I believe, a few municipalities in California. Yeah, Ratio City helps developers and planners better understand, you know, property-based densification, ADU search, again, going more into the marketplace, but they help homeowners understand ADU viability in people's backyards. So yeah, I see that as being one branch. I think there will also be more like vertically integrated housing products that kind of operate with the software, kind of might have a prefab solution, but go from beginning to end with homeowners as a full vertical product. Yeah.
What time interval do you think we'll start seeing some solutions like that? Because you've kind of hinted at the issue in the preparation for this, and I've talked about this many, many times with other guests. The way we build is basically the same as it was 100 years ago, or at least 50 years ago. It hasn't really changed. The quality of building maybe has gone up, or the technical performance of building has gone up. I don't know if the quality has, but the performance has, but that's about it. And it's increasingly more expensive to build, especially if you compare to other industries where the prices of materials and products keeps going down. Or if it doesn't go down, you continuously get more for what you pay. So if you take computers, for example, a computer today is probably just about as expensive as it was. Now, it's probably cheaper than it was 30 years ago, but it's also 100 times or 1,000 times faster. And I still can't figure out why we haven't seen efficiency and cost gains in the architecture and building industry. Because if anything, it should be going down, not up. What's your take on that?
I know, that's a really tricky one. I think it's going to take a builder who is executing something, again, maybe one of these vertically integrated products that's likely prefab, but at such a scale that they, you know, there's an efficiency there where materials are sourced more cheaply, fabrication is so streamlined, you know, cost of labor may be the same as any other worker, but you've just made their time that much more efficient, cut down on, say, 70% of the inefficient time use at a labor level. That brings in huge efficiencies later on in terms of the end price. Also, if you can truly harness, again, do away with all the red tape and leverage, you know, low barrier of entry housing options that don't require as much permitting, that don't require as hefty development charges, that will cut down hugely on the end price of a project, right? Mm. Like when I'm talking to a city planner in Kelowna about ADUs, and I mentioned how Toronto has deferred development charges for, I believe, 20 years, which may be too long of a time on their ADUs, as long as you live on the property, maybe it's 15 years. You know, the Kelowna office says, oh, that's, maybe we should think about that. Like, maybe we should be reducing or deferring development charges to just let in a lower barrier of entry, low-level housing option. So. Yeah.
And so there was a company that showed promise in vertically integrating everything. That was Katerra, that went belly up a couple of years ago. And we haven't really seen anything like that since or even before. And so the promise of, at least in the case of prefabrication, to being the solution to all our woes has failed to materialize, as far as I'm concerned. Maybe there are things happening that I'm not aware of. Because architects have been talking about prefabrication for decades, but it's never become mainstream. It's still a niche kind of service or product. Do you have any idea why?
That architecture is such a niche product.
No, that prefabrication has remained niche when it's been touted as this solution that could solve all the problems? And why isn't it more adopted more broadly?
Yeah, so I think there's one thing, which is literally the construction constraints. What kind of prefab are we talking about? Panelized versus modular? If it's modular, you're looking at what can fit on a tractor, you know, on a truck bed, basically, to ship to site. So that has literal like volumetric constraints, and then what a crane can crane in. In terms of panelization, again, are you getting around, you know, you have certain advantages as a modular builder if you can get CSA approval, right? And if you can get everything permitted in factory with the modular volumetric, great, because then you get 80% of the construction and permitting out of the way, just put it on site. But again, if you can't put that in with the crane at the scale and size that could fit on a truck, and you need to go panelized, that might still require more permitting and checking and planning to get that on site once it's on site, which might just make it at the same level of complexity and having the same timeline as building on site, potentially.
Yeah, I think from what I understand, modular is the more promising of the two. It's more constraining in terms of what you can design, but there's ways around that. The panelized system, what I've been told by clients who use it regularly, is that it produces better built, better performing buildings, but they're not cheaper. It costs about the same, maybe a little more, but you just get higher quality buildings.
You will. Yeah, for sure. Like higher thermal, you know, very good thermal ratings, higher quality. It's not left in the rain while you're building. So of course, like, hey, if you want to pay the same, but just get a higher quality product, great. But again, I still think a builder needs to come in at volume and just produce these quickly. You can also look to Quebec, because I do believe Quebec pricing with their modular builds, both panelized and volumetric, is still more affordable based on labor costs there and material costs.
Yeah, that I've heard that before as well. So we've covered a lot of ground. We kind of went all over the map in terms of the housing shortage and what are some of the causes and the solution. How would you summarize our conversation in a couple sentences? Like what would you want our listeners to take away from this?
Yeah, so I just want to end by saying, you know, why I'm interested in ADUs and missing middle is because we are, again, in this time of immense housing insecurity, housing shortages across the country. So I personally am interested in understanding the three barriers for missing middle, which are financing, construction, and permitting. Mm-hmm. And that's how I kind of situate myself with the work that I'm doing with Density, with the companies that I consult with, you know, the government entities I speak with, because ADUs are part of the solution, not all. And I just love to see more options out there. There is a healthy environment of other startups coming in who are also interested in this, like Partna, which is offering alternative financial solutions to Canadian homeowners. You know, again, ADU Search, Row Homes, all these people who are trying to improve with these three barriers. It'll take time, but I see it happening already.
That's great positive note to end on, because it's easy to get frustrated when talking about this issue. I want to thank you very much for your time. The last question I would have for you is, what has been your favorite part of this interview?
Favorite part? You know, just getting to speak about all of this again and kind of tie this back to the more global issues we face and realizing I'm not alone in my struggle as well. I believe you and others, you're thinking the exact same things. It's just good that we have a forum, you know, through podcasts like this to kind of express ourselves and discuss solutions. So,
yeah, I think conversations like these are where solutions start to emerge. So it's very important to have them.
That's it.
Well, thanks again for your time. It was a great pleasure to have you on the podcast, and hopefully it's not the last time.
For sure. Anytime, I know.
Hey, Arno here. I hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you'll come back for more. Please share with your friends and colleagues, and remember to subscribe on our website at rvltr.studio. Until next time, ciao.